This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll hear from Walt Handelsman, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist, cartoonist for The Advocate, on the joys of his craft in the age of President Trump. Walt Handelsman was a longtime cartoonist with the Times-Picayune, went to Newsday, and is back in Louisiana in a big way with The Advocate. Also, Charles Steinberg, owner of the Pawtucket Paw Sox and public relations strategist, Len Sanderson, on a summit tonight at the LSU Manship School on public funding for professional sports. And local writers Mike Hinton and Sherry Malasaw will join us to talk about their science fiction thriller, Afflicted, book one of the RTX Chronicles. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And if you're dialing locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Email us if you wish at talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Walt Handelsman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for The Advocate. He has twice won the Pulitzer, and Walt Handelsman is now a fixture in Louisiana, native of Baltimore. And he won the Pulitzer in 1997 with the Picayune and in 2007 with Newsday. And he is certainly a busy man as always, and there's always much to draw about as there is to talk about. And good morning to you, Walt Handelsman.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. It's good to hear you. Now, tell us about how it is in the age of Trump. I see a very compelling editorial cartoon in My Advocate today from one Walt Handelsman.
Well, it's certainly an interesting time to be a cartoonist. I actually think it's just an interesting time to, you know, to be an American, to be a journalist, and to be someone who is interested in the news. It's almost as if it's a completely different, than it used to be. I think in terms of doing cartoons and news in general, the pace of the news and I think the way people are at each other's throats is different than anything I've experienced in my 30 plus years as a cartoonist.
When you're drawing Trump, obviously you have a lot of fun with his hair.
Well, absolutely. Every cartoonist looks for something in the president. And I think, you know, people say, who's your favorite president to draw? And it's always the current president. So it's the president turns out to be obviously the number one person that you draw as a cartoonist, and this is true of whether they're Democrats or Republicans. So, you know, with Bill Clinton, there was a big chin, and ironically, we focused a lot on the Monica Lewinsky stuff, which now, again, with the news as it is these days, is just, it seems as if everything that we did in the past is eclipsed by the intensity of the news these days. But in any event, with Hillary, it was her hair and her stature and her pantsuits. And with Obama, it was the shape of his face and his ears. And with I started back with Ronald Reagan, that again was his hair. He had that kind of a glossy bouffant. Jimmy Carter was the teeth and the lips. So Trump has a fun hair to draw. And sort of his build and his red tie are all mainstays of the cartooning.
Well, in today's editorial, there's Trump with a lot of orange hair, small hands, red tie, rather portly midsection. And this one focuses on the Mueller investigation and the GOP. But with Trump, every day is an adventure. This Stormy Daniels story, the girl from Baton Rouge, woman from Baton Rouge, Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, at some point this is bound to be an even bigger story than it already is.
Well, I think so. And I've never I mean, all news is coming at us at a much faster pace because of the way we receive news now. You know, I can remember as a kid, we would get a morning paper, the Baltimore Sun, and then we would get an evening paper, the Evening Sun. I mean, those were the two breaking news. That's where you got your breaking news. And, of course, there was, you know, there was also evening news. So there's so much being thrown at us. And this administration is, you know, either on their own or because so many people either are out to get them or out to find out things about them. I've never seen a situation where in the middle of the day I'll be drawing a cartoon and I'll be flipping through, going back on the web and looking at the news, and there seems to always be a story that one-ups the story that I'm drawing a cartoon about. Uh-huh. And that has never been the case. The speed and the intensity of the news, it's just amazing. And I've talked to other cartoonists. I'm friends with a bunch of cartoonists around the country. And they all said the same thing. So it's not just me sort of wondering. It's the speed with which all this stuff is coming at us is intense. I think on the other hand, there tends to be so much analysis. There's so much discussion on cable news on both sides that it's maddening. I mean, it's all, you know, there's just over-analysis and over-commentary. There seems to be no time to digest what's happening in many cases. So it's different than it used to be. And I guess we'll find out in the future mm-hmm. whether or not this was a Trump phenomenon or whether this was a news and internet and delivery system phenomenon. I think it's probably more to do with the administration and the amount of stuff that's happening on a daily basis.
Was a highly decorated editorial cartoonist, what do you make of this mantra of fake news?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think the more we learn about Facebook, and we know that fake news on the internet exists. We have ample evidence of stories written by non-existent reporters that it's just fabricated stuff. And you know, I think one of the things as a journalist that bothers me is that this throwing around of fake news has, you know, I think it undermines the importance of what journalism is all about. And I think that's a dangerous thing, and you know, not to be too dramatic, but I do think that, you know, all the news that you read or hear or see on the internet is all the real news is generated by news organizations, actual people, reputable people. And so I think claiming fake news because you don't like a story is silly. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's worrisome. And again, I hate to keep sounding old, but I guess I am old. I've been doing this a while, but when you have whole industries within education teaching news journalism, that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. And I know that I believe that's going on at LSU. I know that it was going on at Stony Brook in New York and in some other places where they're actually, you know, training young people how to read the news, what's real, mm-hmm. because so many people are getting their news either from Facebook or from they were getting it from Jon Stewart when he was on TV, and I don't know. I think it can be a dangerous thing to not have the concept of what is real, tangible, reliable, good news, which is one of the reasons that I'm happy to still work for a newspaper. I'm happy that you know, the Advocate is a respected newspaper in the state. I'm happy that the Advocate is 7 days a week in New Orleans. I think that's all important stuff.
When did you decide this is what you wanted to do with your life?
I was in college, and I was in advertising. I was getting a degree in kind of advertising. It was a general studies degree that I had worked out with the University of Cincinnati, where I got a bachelor's degree. And I liked the idea of doing cartoons. I loved the editorial cartoons that I was seeing in student newspaper and that I saw in the Baltimore Sun. And so when I got home from college, I had a degree in advertising. I had a marketing and a business combination degree, and I went back to Baltimore, and I went and I called on the cartoonists at the Baltimore Sun, who were extremely nice to meet this, you know, 20-year-old kid who knew nothing about cartooning. They were very generous with their time, and I got to spend the day with both of them. This was Tom Flannery and Mike Lane. And I went home and just decided that I wanted to try and do this as a freelancer. And one thing led to another, and I was doing a little bit of freelance cartooning. I landed a job in advertising, and the next thing I knew, I was doing this full-time for a little tiny newspaper in Columbia, Maryland.
We'll return and spend more time with Walt Handelsman of The Advocate after this brief pause on WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And the email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're spending more time with Walt Handelsman, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for The Advocate. He's written 7 collections of his editorial cartoons, as well as a children's book. And he returned to Louisiana after winning his second Pulitzer with Newsday. In 2013, he left to come to The Advocate. He's based in New Orleans. Of course, The Advocate is now the daily newspaper for both of the biggest cities in Louisiana. And, Walt, why did you come back?
Well, my family and I have always felt a very strong connection to New Orleans and to Louisiana in general. And the kids were getting a little bit older, and post-Katrina, I think we were even closer. We came back. I came back multiple times right after the storm. The connection was very strong. It had been strong, and actually felt as I was in New York longer that it was getting stronger. And I was so disappointed with what was happening with the Times-Picayune going to 3 days a week and so many of my friends losing their jobs. It was just, I just thought it was a very disappointing and unsettling situation for my friends. And I felt really bad that the city of New Orleans was going to have a newspaper for 3 days a week, which I thought was it made no sense, and I thought it was unfair to the people of the city. I understand the stresses on the newspaper business, but none of it made any sense to me. And I had a couple of conversations, and an offer was made, and I thought this is a great time to be able to reconnect with Louisiana. And my children were a little bit older, and it was going to be my wife and myself in a couple of years, which it is now. So it all seemed to come together and make sense. And when I came back here, one of the first things that was in the news was Ray Nagin. Mm-hmm. Then Edwin Edwards was running for Congress. David Duke was running. Bobby Jindal was still here. It was really quite an amazing array of names and faces. And as a cartoonist, you have to know that there are few places probably in the world that are so much fun to be a cartoonist as Louisiana. I mean, New York was great, But Louisiana is just the perfect combination. First of all, the readers have a tremendous sense of humor here. I do a cartoon caption contest item for the newspaper. It runs every other week. And we did it in New York with some success, but nothing like here. I mean, the sort of sense of humor and combination of the sense of humor tied in with their love of politics is so strong here. So it's a great place to draw cartoons. And I have so many friends here. We just love it in Louisiana, and I've learned to love Baton Rouge. I didn't know a lot about Baton Rouge. I had been there a couple of times, but now I go up there. I go to the Advocate, I'd say, a couple of times a month, and I've gone to some social events there. So it's really, I think it's fun being with the Advocate. I think it's really closed the gap between the two cities, which is already very close as it is with the LSU connection and so many other things. So it's been great. It's been great to be back.
In 40 years of doing this, are there some favorites as far as targets you've had from your editorial cartoon delivery?
Well, it's funny. I was at a wedding the other day, and the publisher of the Times-Picayune, Ashton Phelps, was there, and we were talking about what I always considered to be the most, you know, the most fun time to be a cartoonist was during the Bill Clinton administration. Of course, with cartooning, bad news is good news for cartooning. And the Monica Lewinsky scandal was so outrageous for its day. I mean, it's hard to remember back then how, you know, just over the top reading stories about the stuff that happened in a print, you know, in a newspaper was really shocking. It was really unbelievable stuff. And the cartoons that I got away with at that time were unbelievable. And we were just laughing about it because, I mean, I used to have people call me up and they're just multiple stories about things that happened during those days that made it really, it was just kind of fun and an interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of the presidents and all of the sort of decades of cartooning that I've done, it's always been interesting. There's never been a time where you're like, well, that was a bad 10 years. Never. Huh. I mean, it just doesn't exist, especially in Louisiana. I mean, in Louisiana, if something on the national scene isn't jumping off the page, there's five things jumping off the page here. I mean, it's just an unbelievable string of stuff that goes on here, whether it's, you know, these crazy budget and financial battles, or, you know, some kind of wild scandals, or the political races in and of themselves are just fascinating to watch. And some of the stuff that they throw out when they're in session, some of the bills that come up are unbelievable. I mean, it's just this stuff writes itself.
Yeah.
The question is, how can you draw it? How can you keep up with it all? And in reality, the question really is, what are people paying close attention to? You know, that's my main goal, is to try and sort of do something that people don't have to thumb through the paper and figure out, what am I talking about? What's the topic? So here, local topics are very big, and local political topics really get a lot of play. So,
Well, recently you had kind of a touching cartoon about Tom Benson. Editorial cartoonists are known for inflicting pain on occasion to some of these people. Like, for example, when I see President Obama or President Bush, I think ears. But you actually paid tribute to Tom Benson in one of your cartoons of the last week.
Well, I think I did, and I. And also Stephen Hawking the same week. So I do try and mix up my cartoons. I think it would be boring and somewhat of a disservice to the readers if every day you just pounded people over the head. I don't think it would be fun to read. And I think people might tune out. But obviously, the Tom Benson story and the Tom Benson death, which it's a big deal. It was a big deal for the region. He was a big figure. And as a big Saints fan, a really big Saints fan, I mean, he's a big figure in that part of, in that part of my life. And so I did do a tribute cartoon about him, saying St. Peter is welcoming him to heaven, saying, welcome to your skybox. Everyone here is a saint. So, I thought it was a little sappy. But again, it wasn't, as you pointed out, it wasn't supposed to be, sort of your traditional gut punch, obviously. It was a tribute. I've done quite a few of those in my career. And interestingly enough, I find those to be very popular. And I think it goes to show that people like a little break from the gut punches, and they like to be able to celebrate or appreciate something or someone or some group because that's how they feel. And I've done stuff on the Cajun Navy, which always gets tremendous reaction because people like when you can put, into a visual sense some of the things they're.
Walt, we thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. Continue your great work, and we're pleased to have you in Louisiana. Pulitzer Prize winner twice, Walt Handelsman of The Advocate. Thank you, Walt.
Thank you, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be back with Lynn Sanderson, Charles Steinberg. They've got some interesting things to say about professional sports. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar are producing. And again, your number is 877-217-5757. Tonight from 7 to 9 o'clock at the Manship School of Mass Communication, there will be a summit focusing on public funding in sports. And with us is Charles Steinberg, the Pawtucket Paw Sox president and former head of communications for the Orioles, Padres, and Red Sox. And Lynn Sanderson is also in-house, a man who many of us know from his years at the very top levels of government in Louisiana with former Governor Charles Elson Buddy Romer. But Lynn Sanderson has become quite prolific in the world of Major League and Minor League Baseball, and it's good to have both of you in studio.
Well, thanks. It's my first time to Baton Rouge. I'm happy to be here.
Well, the Pawtucket Paw Sox, you've got an $83 million stadium, right?
Well, there's the talk of one. Yeah, yeah. Right now we play in a 76-year-old stadium that I think cost about $2.5 million in 1942.
So it's served its...
It has done its job, yeah, and then some.
And innovative ways to get people to come to the park. I lived in a minor league town for 10 years as a kid in Little Rock, and, it's kind of frustrating when players get good, that's when they move on to the next level. And in your case, you're a Triple-A team. That means quite often they're moving on to the next level, being the major leagues.
Well, in fairness, Jim, you did move on from Little Rock, too.
So. Yeah, I didn't say that, didn't you?
Yeah. No, it's true. If you fall in love with the ball players, they're not going to be there that long. And it's true. Baseball is still the core. It's the magnet. It's what draws people. And it's still a beautiful intergenerational sport that fosters conversation. But yes, you have to still be 10 years old. And I think I still am 10 years old. And yet today's 10-year-old has more opportunities in childhood to be stimulated by a variety of attractions. And you have to realize that. So if you try to do things the same old way they were done, you're going to find that your attendance dwindles because there are a lot of other magnets that are drawing people. But if you stay inside the mind of today's 10-year-old or 8-year-old, you can come to a ballpark, come to a venue, come with your friends, come with your families, come with your grandparents, and you can have a wonderful time, get to know the players, and continue to root for them as they go up to Boston, in the case of the Paw Sox. But also, some of the constants are your mascots. And to a six-year-old, that's great. Our two polar bears, Paws and Socks, they don't get called up to Boston. And you can really provide people with a wonderful, stimulating time that creates great memories. And today, to me, your children are your publicists. They've got their cell phones at 9 years old in many cases. And they want to take pictures everywhere they can in the ballpark. And they'll take care of the social media for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us what you're doing on Tuesday nights.
In Pawtucket. Yesterday we announced the Paw Sox are one of 33 teams in minor league baseball. There are 160 minor league franchises that have been given the opportunity to do a new innovative outreach program to Spanish-speaking fans. And we're taking our polar bears, which in Spanish, as we all know, is Osos Polares. And the team will be called the Osos Polares on Tuesdays. And we'll create an environment at the ballpark in which we make inroads. You can't just open your ballpark and expect that everyone's going to deign to come visit you. Mm-hmm. You have to make the first move. You have to make the first step. And we have a lot of people in Rhode Island and in southeastern Massachusetts, and this is a story that's all over the country, who have come from other places, and you have to go bring the basket of cookies to them. Mm-hmm. So you want to reach out and speak the language in which they're comfortable as you use baseball the way it has always been used, as a unifier of various cultures. 100 years ago, 110, 20 years ago, Italian immigrants would fall in love with America through baseball. Irish, Jewish, it's been a story that's an American tale. And that's what we want to do, is make sure we're reaching out to everyone. And we'll speak any language any fan speaks.
How do you say polar bear in Gaelic? You got that? and Jim, would you repeat back the name of the polar bears in Spanish? I'd like to hear that.
I think he did it very well.
Osos for bears. Okay. Polares.
All right, well, let me ask you a question.
Osos Polares.
If the polar bear, why would a polar bear want to advance to become Wally the Green Wall? I mean,
the Green Monster?
Yeah.
He doesn't. He stays in Pawtucket.
I'd rather be a polar bear than a wall.
Well, and why do we have polar bears? Now, this is not the actual story, but the story we're going to tell the kids. Because, okay, you know, the New England is under yet another siege of snow, right, today, right? Ah. Well, the polar bears grew up at the North Pole. They had internships with the happy, jolly fellow with the long white beard who wore red stockings on his feet.
Ah, okay.
And when they moved to America, to a land of opportunity, they wanted to go to a place where the climate all too often reminded them of the North Pole. But you got warmth in the summer.
Did you make this up just now?
Wait till I read you the children's story that we've written.
Yeah, okay. Quite a storyteller is Charles Steinberg, the Pawtucket Paw Sox president. Yeah. That's a mouthful. And the ball club is the only sports professional team in Rhode Island, correct?
Yeah, there's the P Bruins. The Providence Bruins are a minor league hockey team, an affiliate of the Boston Bruins.
Well, how important is it to get public financing for your franchise?
That's up to the people of a community. How important is it to you to have a professional sports team? Now, there's a distinction to be made. There isn't any ask of money for the team. Not a dollar, not a cent. What you have a great history mm-hmm. of in the United States is public infrastructure, so that you can build facilities so that private business does business. Nobody says boo about building an airport with public funds so that Delta can come and pay you the fees mm-hmm. to land here. Well, just as when we were with the Baltimore Orioles, the state of Maryland had the wisdom to build a venue, Oriole Park at Camden Yards, so that the Baltimore Orioles would pay fair share of rent and bring life, vitality, and 3 million people to a revitalized downtown. So how important is it to you, whether it's Rhode Island or whether it was Milwaukee or whether it was San Diego, you name the city, San Francisco, Denver, so many minor league cities too, how important is it to you, how much of your identity comes from having a professional sports team, particularly a baseball team. And I say particularly because in basketball, hockey, bowling, you're walking into a box. You're going into an enclosed arena. Even for football, it's a giant bowl.
Mm-hmm.
But a ballpark is a commercial for the city. It's a commercial for the state. You watch a Cubs game out of Wrigley Field, you see Chicago. Fenway, you see Boston. Camden Yards, mm-hmm. you see Baltimore. Right. So there are many public benefits to having a public venue.
All right. Well, in Louisiana, Tom Benson, the Saints owner, died a few days ago.
He's
worth $2.8 billion. Mm-hmm. Only billionaire in Louisiana, Lynn Sanderson, and yet he and his team.
Other than you, Jim.
Okay, well, Tom Benson gets $165 million each year from the state of Louisiana. I don't get quite that much, but should we be giving this kind of money to a billionaire?
You know, I think that's the wrong question. I remember when this issue came up in Milwaukee, and we polled it different ways, frankly. I remember when someone asked the question that way, and of course everybody says no. But then when we asked the question a different way, and that is, what does this franchise mean to you personally? What does it mean to you in the state of Wisconsin to be a Packer, to be a Badger, to be a Brewer, or to be a Buck? And it meant an awful lot. I remember, Jim, that there were 78% of the people in the state of Wisconsin that said they'd never been to the old county stadium in Milwaukee. But of those 78%, but it's part of my personal identity. And am I willing to pay a penny out of every $10 to keep Major League Baseball in Milwaukee and make it a part of my self-definition? Yeah. Do I want to be a Major League city? Yeah. Do I want to have this venue for families? Yeah. Baseball, unlike some of the others, also has 81 home games a year. 81 home games a year.
Major League.
Major League, right. And what happens there is about 80% of every audience every night that goes to a game comes with members of their family. That's not true with any other sport. With baseball, it's more of a family kind of situation. There's more accessibility to the game. And I think that it's also a game that, regardless of gender, you've probably played. From your 5 or 6 years old, the first mm-hmm. game you probably are familiar with is baseball, or softball, or kickball. You've played some sort of diamond sports. So there's an accessibility there and a relationship. Doc just talked about the relationship that you have with players, but some of that has to do with when you're a kid, who do you relate to on the field? Maybe not the star, maybe the smallest player, maybe the largest player, maybe the slowest player, maybe the fastest player. You have a different kind of relationship. And one of the things I was proudest of in Major League Baseball over the past 25 years that I've worked with them is I think the biggest growth audience from about 1997 to 2007 were single mothers bringing their families. Because it meant I could entertain my family, I could feed my family, bring them to a safe environment, knowing exactly what they could expect. And Mom said it also allowed me to be a human being. We could be a fan. If I go to dinner, it becomes a deposition. If I go to a movie, we don't talk at all. If I go to a game, then I get to be a real person. I get to root for the team, and we get to just talk.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Lynn Sanderson and Charles Steinberg tonight, a summit on public funding in professional sports and sports in general at LSU at the Manship School, 7 to 9 p.m. And then we'll hear from two accomplished local authors, Mike Hinton and Cherry Malasaw. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. In studio for a few more minutes, Charles Steinberg, the president of the Pawtucket Paw Sox, about to move into an $83 million stadium. By the way, LSU has built an $85 million recreation center that you might want to take a look at. $85 million for a rec center at Tiger Town.
It must be good.
It's really, really good. And it's so good that it makes the library look rather
tame. Have you actually wrecked there, Jim? Do you know if it's a good...
I go to an old fashioned gym. I was there at 10 o'clock last night.
Is that right?
I sure was. Yeah.
Well, you look dazzling, Jim. Well, you just really do.
I was fishing for a compliment, so thanks. But
for those of people that don't know, Jim does not wear pants.
In these
radio shows, he does wear garters and boots, but no pants.
Jim, that's your old friend talking to you.
It is friends like that. But tonight, a lot of luminaries in the worlds of professional sports will be on hand, including your colleague Denise Michaels from Sanderson Strategies and Charles Steinberg's the keynoter for this summit on funding in sports. And there is certainly concern about funding of all kinds in government now. We don't like taxes, but we've got to have a government. And is this a luxury or is this a necessity, Lynn Sanderson?
I think, Doc said it earlier, that is a decision for, for individual localities to make. And I think that a lot of that has to do with what constitutes your quality of life. I can't imagine Louisiana, particularly post-Katrina, without the Tigers and without the Saints. They were hugely important to the makeup of Louisianians going through things. It's part of our self-definition, Jim, and it's part of kind of our local spirituality. And that is a value. What value do you put on that? And I think that's an important question. But I can't imagine Louisiana without those valuable assets, and we wouldn't have them if we didn't have the Superdome.
And in our talk in Rhode Island about a new ballpark, let's understand, people don't like to pay taxes, you're right. Do they like it when the tax revenue exceeds the expense? You see, the revenues that come to Rhode Island because they have the PawStocks are significantly greater than the public investment. And the public investment is a small fraction. This is going to be privately funded by the owners to a majority. So $45 million of it will be funded by the ball club, even though it's a public venue with year-round uses, and it generates more money for the state than the state's investment.
Well, thanks for coming this way, and I hope you're impressed with Louisiana, Charles.
I already am, and Len's given me a tour, and it's a beautiful place, and the hospitality is very noticeable. And so thank you.
It's great to see you again, Len Sanderson.
Mr. Engster.
Take care, my friend.
You bet.
And we're joined now by two accomplished writers with their first work, and it is quite a tour de force, Afflicted, book one of the RTX Chronicles from Mike Hinton, Michael B. Hinton, and Sherry R. Malasaw. And they have quite a story to tell about getting into the world of publishing and having their work available for public consumption. 877-217-5757. Mike was raised in Ruston. His grandfather, Barry Hinton, was a longtime baseball coach at Louisiana Tech. And Sherry was in the second grade when she won her first award for writing a short story. And it's good to see both of you.
Great. Thanks for having us, Jim.
Now, how did this project come about, Sherry?
Well, Mike and my husband, Neil, who you, I believe, know, they were roommates in college. And we play a lot of role-playing games, and in role-playing games, you basically tell stories. Mm-hmm. You create a character, and those characters tell stories. And Mike and I really got into the storytelling aspect of playing games, and we essentially drove everyone crazy with all of the long stories that we would tell, and so they said, why don't you two write a book? And so that's what we did.
And this is, as I said, a tour de force. It's the first of what is likely to be a trilogy.
Yes, yes. We have actually finished about one-third of the rough draft for book two already.
Book two is coming after book one, and book one is now available. This is the unveiling week of it, and I know this is a labor of love, but a lot of elbow grease had to happen for this to be available, and it's a beautiful book. Mike, congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, we spent probably a total of 6 years on and off writing this. It wasn't a thorough process because we were working at other jobs, but yes, it has definitely been a labor of love, and we're really pleased to have it out there.
How did you... how did you come up with this remarkable storyline?
Well, it started out as a game, actually, that me and Mike and my husband Neil played, and each of us had a character, and those are the three main characters of the book. So the book is called Afflicted. It's book one of the RTX Chronicles. R stands for Ruddy, who's one of the characters. T stands for Terry, and X stands for Zeke, Zeke with an X. And
mm-hmm. It's Ruddy Unglesby, too.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
I know only of one other Unglesby, I know of Lewis and his son, but that's an unusual Louisiana name.
I've always liked that name, Jim, and Unglesby. I've always wanted to use it in a book.
Well, so. There you go, Ruddy Unglesby. The apocalypse came and went in a single day when the smoke cleared, half the people in the world were dead. As government fought to stay intact, dangerous powers manifested in a few of the survivors. That's the hook. That's a pretty big hook.
Yeah, it is. All three of our characters do have superpowers, and it's not all it's cracked up to be in this world. In fact, I think it causes more problems for them than it does solutions. In addition, they are very deeply flawed and scarred individuals, and so they have a lot to deal with.
How is the sci-fi genre going as far as contemporary writers?
Well, I think it's probably the best genre out there right now. And I may be, you know, a little biased because I'm a longtime, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars fan, and I love both Marvel and DC comics, and I'm a bit of a nerd, you know, always have been. And I think it's the best time for people who are into stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at all of the movies that are out right now that are doing so well.
Well, you describe yourself as an Army brat, which means that you don't know where you came from?
No, I have absolutely no idea where I'm from. When people ask me that question, I don't know what to say.
So usually where you went to high school. Like, I'm a New Orleans native, but I went to high school in Little Rock, so Len Sanderson calls me a Little Rock native. But you...
I went to high school in both West Virginia and in Auburn, Alabama. Hopefully there's not too many boos out there as I say those words. And I also went to college in Auburn, but I got my master's degree from UAB.
There you go. And Mike?
I'm from Ruston. I went to Ruston High, Louisiana Tech. Studied under Wiley Hilburn there. Great man. Journalism professor. So that's where my history is. I came down to LSU in 96 for my graduate degree, and I've kind of been around Baton Rouge since, except for a brief tour living in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about how the two of you came together, but you would write conversations about the games that you were involved in. How did that go?
Well, we would get finished with the games, and we would be at a place, kind of a stopping place for our characters, and we would sit down, and at the time, it was mostly email we did it by, because that was the big medium 6 or 7 years ago, and we would just email stories back and forth about our characters, and we would really get into it, and it would become where the character conversations were actually taking more of our time than the game, and that's when our fellow gamers said, you guys should write a book.
And how do these characters respond to having these special powers?
Well, they respond differently. I think in the world that we've created, having these powers doesn't actually give you any advantage over anyone else because you're both in demand mm-hmm. by the government and also feared by most everyone around you, and they deal with it very differently. Most of them are running, and
it was, I'm sure, a challenge to get it published. But you've stayed the course.
Yes, well, publishing is great. It's a great time to publish because you can do it all yourself. You can use Amazon, Kindle on Demand, things like that. So it's a wonderful time to be an author, and it's a wonderful time to be able to get your work out there.
And dedicated is the book to one Neil Melanson, the lesser half of Sherry, who's a public relations specialist with the Louisiana Farm Bureau and, of course, an accomplished journalist as well. So Neil was a big inspiration, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually coming with us to SciFiCon in April. There's a convention in Lake Charles that happens every year. It's the largest convention, science fiction convention in Louisiana. It's April 6th through the 8th at the Lake Charles Civic Center.
And you'll be able to find out much more about Afflicted, but the book is available at Amazon and other places.
Right, yes. It's available in both ebook and in hardcover.
Well, we thank you for joining us, and congratulations, Sherry Malasaw and Michael Hinton. The book is Afflicted. Thanks for listening.
For the podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.